On this week's On the Media, we shudder, we worry, we shelter, we Zoom. But with almost 100,000 COVID dead, do we as a nation grieve?
Each day, we're seeing 1,000 or 2,000 people dying as if we're having a new 9/11 every 2 days.
Something has changed dramatically since 9/11 with regards to our ability as a nation to set aside politics and mourn together.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain.
What we want to try and do is figure out a way that death isn't just a graph going up and going down, but are full sentences for a full life.
In my earliest obits in the early 1800s, people were resigned to their fate, and their obit would say she was ready to meet the summons of her God.
The processing of mass death. After this.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Today, 1,000 and another 1,000 and another 1,000 is our lead.
This morning, with nearly every state in the nation relaxing at least some restrictions, the U.S. reaching a grim milestone. 1.5 million cases of COVID, with the death toll nearing 90,000.
The U.S. death toll stands at 88,101. The CDC projected today it'll be at 100,000 by June 1st.
Earlier this year, we struggled to comprehend the ominous arithmetic of the nascent pandemic. But we don't need projections for big numbers anymore. We have them. So we compare old losses with new ones by the numbers.
Well, each day, we're seeing 1,000 or 2,000 people dying as if we're having a new 9/11 every 2 days.
Like to say that's two, you know, 747s a day, maybe three a day of passengers who would be dying. That's what the coronavirus is doing, and I don't like to present
it's the rough equivalent of 32 Hurricane Marias, 43 Johnstown floods, 565 Oklahoma City bombings, 650 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fires, with at least 34 more to come by month's end. But even those scales are too abstract. Maybe to really take the measure of this pandemic, we simply have to count one by one.
Julia Rivera Collazo, 73, Bronx, New York. Gladys Hernandez, 75, Bronx, New York. Victor Olivero, 60, Bronx, New York. Mary Bello, 86, Manhattan. Sarita Burkett, 44.
On Wednesday, a group of people who've lost loved ones and faith leaders joined in a 24-hour online vigil called Naming the Lost. Though, as Casey Sepp pointed out in The New Yorker last week, reading all the names of all the Americans who we know have died would take at least 3 days. And that assumes there's a list, and there isn't. The City is a nonprofit news site covering New York City, and it plans to build a list, at least here in the epicenter. It aims to turn statistics into names and ultimately into an archive of obituaries for nearly every New Yorker killed by this disease. Because, as the City and its partners have found, the obituaries so far fail to accurately represent the dead. Too many people, too many communities are missing.
We want to find a way where every person has, you know, 20 lines, 20 words, three paragraphs of their life that makes them unique to their family and makes them unique to New York.
Terry Paris Jr. is the engagement editor of The City.
We're trying to crowdsource stories. We will rely on social shoe leather journalism. We're going to call every single funeral home. We will be partnering with various local news organizations, some of which will be in different languages. And we're also going to be translating this ourselves into Spanish, Korean, and Yiddish. It will take a year or so, who knows, but we want to figure out a way to track as many of those deaths, as many of those people, talk to as many of those families as we possibly can.
A lot of these deaths happen in hospitals that are overrun, at home, in the loneliest parts of society. I mean, this has to present a hurdle that's hard to overcome.
My heart just sunk when you said that, because it is such an enormous project. It is such an enormous hurdle. And so we want to sort of be investigative reporters and be incredibly empathic with what we're doing and figure out the best ways to reach those folks. And we, for example, have a list of deaths on Hart's Island, but we don't exactly know where they're all coming from, or we have their names and their, you know, last known addresses.
I'm guessing that you have a lot of lists, right? I mean, lists from the Hasidic Community News, lists from unions, the United Federation of Teachers. A lot of groups keep track of their own.
This is exactly right. COVID, in terms of thinking about the deaths, have made lists upon lists upon lists, and they're all in different places. We wanted to tie these all together and make basically this clearinghouse and bring all of these names and all of these faces and all of these stories into one place. How do we make these lists publicly available? How can they be searched? How can they be grouped? How can the display be something that is sophisticated and honorable for what we're losing? Just like folks who have come to New York to volunteer in the healthcare industry, to come out of retirement in some cases, we want reporters to help us tell these stories, to sort of give back in the ways that we know they want to. Immediately publishing this story, got dozens of emails from reporters asking me exactly this. How can I volunteer my time to help tell these stories?
Now, what do you mean by tell these stories? Do you mean write an obituary?
We mean reach out to this family, talk to the person who knows about the taxi driver or the MTA conductor, the longtime Little League coach. Create some memorial of an obituary that isn't 20 lines and costs $150, that isn't a string of words separated by semicolons, but are full sentences. There is this disproportionate skew towards wealthier folks in wealthier neighborhoods. If you look at the obituaries, they're cost prohibitive. In the New York Daily News, an obituary can cost $600. The New York Times, at the cheapest, it's $250, and that gets a one-day run in the paper and on digital. With so many folks dying right now, and with the terms of grief changing so dramatically, we believe that something like this might just help us better come to terms. You know, it's a big project, but it's a small little thing that we as journalists might be able to do to help folks better celebrate that taxi driver, or that MTA conductor, or that longtime Little League coach.
How much trouble do laws on privacy, especially health privacy, HIPAA restrictions and so forth, pose in this effort?
We are not encouraging doctors or those who may be working with families in a social work capacity or a therapy capacity to share the names. We're merely asking them to share this information with their networks in the hopes that those folks might want to participate.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, as the names come in, we have an army of folks. It's a small army, but it's an army nonetheless, of folks who are proactively reaching out to these groups. We are asking in our call out the name, the age, when they died, something that makes them unique, if they have any underlying conditions. As the names come in, we call people or email people and we'll verify these items. This doesn't go right from the submitted form to the internet in public. We're journalists. We trust but verify. And that's what we'll be doing with this project too.
You talked about your army. That isn't very big. Exactly. How big is it? I mean, how close do you think you can get to meeting your goal? Because even as you address the numbers, they keep going up.
Right now, we have slotted between 5 to 10 researchers, postgrad fellows, and interns. The phase two component of asking reporters to help us verify and report out these stories has not happened yet. And so we hope that dozens would sign on to this, but we will see where we get through this summer, and then we'll have to figure out a way to increase the size of that army for the fall and for the spring and through next summer, because it's not something that's going to happen within the next 6 months. These numbers are going to keep going up. We're not done. We're not out of the woods yet.
Why do this? I mean, I know the New York Times is making an effort to feature people who are beloved in their communities but are not famous or rich or even white. It's a drop in the bucket, I know. So many people will be overlooked. What drives you?
Not from COVID, but my mother and brother passed away within a year of each other. And one of them got an obituary and one of them didn't. And even in that obituary was a handful of sentences and a bunch of semicolons. And I really believe that that does not do anyone justice. There's a full life lived, and 20 words at $100 is not a full life. Oftentimes, we look to the media, to TV and newspapers for validations of a life well lived. And when that is hard for lots of people to attain, particularly in a time like this, that feels bad. That feels unjust. I think sometimes we forget who we're serving and we forget why we're serving them. You see some really great things happen, but you also see people being left behind when it comes to news and information and story. I think this is the project that could help us think differently about who we're trying to reach and why we're trying to reach them.
There was a piece in the Washington Post earlier this week titled, "This Feels Great." And it described a mall in suburban Atlanta where people were delighted to return to quote-unquote normal. As one man put it, when you start seeing where the cases are coming from and the demographics, I'm not worried.
Mm-hmm. When I saw that, I had to close my computer and it was like, this is why we're doing this. Because there's this sort of callousness because we just see the number. And that man's quote, it's just heartbreaking to hear and see something like that when so many people are losing so many loved ones to this disease. And frankly, who will just be forgotten. It's yet another example of why this project is so important.
To end the isolation?
To absolutely end this isolation.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, Brooke.
Terry Paris Jr. is the engagement editor for The City.
Coming up, can we mourn as a nation anymore?
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Obituary projects like the one run by The City in New York are an attempt to reckon with the ongoing disaster and to create a record for the future. But according to the historian Janice Hume, author of Obituaries in American Culture, we'll only truly understand this pandemic when it's over. And years from now, COVID-19 obituaries will help researchers tell the story of our time, who we cared about, and what we cherished. Janice, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
You studied 8,000 obits from 1818 to 1930, and you saw a reflection of the changing society and of the collective consciousness.
I did. I found that in the 19th century, for example, people were remembered more for attributes of character than for their resume. And so men were remembered for being brave and valorous, and women were remembered for being patient and obedient and affectionate. And that's not just a general impression. I literally counted the words in those 8,000 obituaries. Every time the word obedient was used, I counted it. It was so common for them that I don't think anybody would have thought anything of it at the time. And if somebody called me obedient in my obituary, I think I would come back and haunt them. It's very interesting, though, when we move into the 20th century and we move past the Industrial Revolution, people were remembered not so much for attributes of character, but men were remembered for how much money they made, how much land they owned, and women were remembered for their connections with men.
the whole nomenclature of death has changed a great deal. At some points, it's quite, gothic or perhaps rococo.
In my earliest obits in the early 1800s, people were resigned to their fate, and their obit would say she was ready to meet the summons of her god. But when we moved further into the 19th century, the language got a lot more colorful. And so rather than an obituary saying that someone died, it would say they were scathed by the wing of the destroying angel or removed from our midst by the fell destroyer. And then post-Civil War, most of that language stopped. And a lot of scholars have noted how there were so many lives lost in the Civil War that it became almost unpatriotic to dwell on death post-Civil War. And so you really saw that in those obituaries. That language went away. People went back to just dying of a particular cause.
I suppose the battlefield photographs by Matthew Brady and others would make you disinclined to be flowery. Those soldiers didn't look scathed. They just looked dead.
Those photographs weren't published in newspapers because we didn't have that technology yet, but people saw them in showings, galleries, and were horrified by them. They were so lifelike. It was a stark reminder of what war was really like.
Obits are not typically gimlet-eyed views of a person's life. You'd never see John Doe, a drunken abuser of his family, died in agony and shame. And yet, even if they aren't great journalism, you still find them useful.
I'm not looking necessarily for those obituaries to reveal fact to me. I'm looking for those obituaries to reveal culture. Now, if I were a genealogist and I'm researching the history of my family, getting the names right, getting the dates right, all of that is critically important to my research. But if I'm looking at the media as a reflection of culture and helping us understand it over time, the factuality of that obit is less important to me for that purpose.
What about modern American obits? Clearly, we're past scathed by the wing of the destroying angel.
That's correct.
But where have we landed in 2020?
I think in 2020, we're less concerned about the stigma of a cause of death, I hope, though there have been times over history that people didn't want to use the word cancer. Certainly people at a certain point didn't want to use HIV/AIDS. But, you know, I think we've moved, I hope, past that to where we're honest about a cause of death, particularly with the online obituaries, with the legacy.com. I think you see a lot of, I guess, loosening up. Pets are sometimes listed in the survivors. I know that there have been a couple of occasions of people that I know who wrote their own obituary, which again brings a totally different perspective than an obituary written by a journalist or by a family member. And those typically are a little bit self-effacing. They can be humorous. But I still think no matter who writes them and where they're published, they still serve that function of helping us understand who we are and what we value at a particular point in time.
Now, I think pretty much universally, obits are written for a contemporary audience, you know, with little or no thought to whether
yes.
a century later someone like you will be mining it for insight about 2020 culture. Is it better that way? Or should journalists and survivors have somewhere in the back of their minds that this obituary is also a time capsule?
I think that journalists should serve their audiences and leave the historians to figure it out. Mainstream newspapers reflect mainstream culture. And I really looked at and considered and wrote about what I call the silences on obituary pages. Who's left out? If you were African American in the 19th century, for example, you were going to be remembered only if you served some sort of other news value. There were a number of African Americans who were remembered in obits because they were over 100 years old, and that's going to be newsworthy in that era. There were vastly more men remembered than women. So we have to be careful when we take a look back at history at the prism that we're looking through.
Well, on the subject of prisms, it strikes me that in a pandemic whose toll is measured in such unimaginable death counts, that death itself becomes more abstract. What role does the obituary have in keeping us uninured by just the sheer scale of it all?
Well, by definition, an obituary is about a single person, a single American life. And if we are a society that values lives equally, remembering somebody in an obituary becomes, I think, really important. And it helps us focus on that these are human beings and not numbers, people who are different from each other and who have different triumphs, different contributions that they've made. And how can you do that except in an obituary? Of course, we have news coverage, and they've done a really nice job of highlighting individuals who've died. But if you're going to really get a sense of the vast majority of the people who passed away during this pandemic, you're going to have to look at obits.
Well, we have had exhaustive news coverage. We've also had a lot of anxiety, a lot of horror. What we haven't had, it seems to me, is a lot of mourning. Am I imagining this, that communal grief is absent, and that as a consequence, the obit has taken on a more outsized role?
You know, we have people standing in windows and applauding healthcare workers is about the only communal ritual that we've seen, but we are still in the midst of it. We're all afraid to leave our houses, you know, and it's hard to grieve alone. But the obit remains, and that is something that we can use. It's only a small part of the grieving process. I'm not trying to make out like it's the be-all, end-all of everything, of course. But remembering the deceased in an individual article that people read and share is an important part of the grieving process.
Janice, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Janice Hume is a professor at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication. Hume says that moments of large-scale communal mourning are rare in this moment, despite the ever-mounting death toll. On Friday, following public pressure from congressional Democrats, President Trump did tweet his intention to order flags to half-staff on Memorial Day weekend. Was it perfunctory? As Colin Dickey observed in a recent piece for the magazine Gen, previous presidents have not hesitated to unite the nation in communal grief.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering.
Ronald Reagan, following the Challenger disaster of 1986, for instance.
We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss.
The Challenger tragedy, of course, happened in one split second. The pandemic has raged for months with no end in sight. Is it just too soon to grieve?
More than the fact that it's an open-ended tragedy, it is a politically inconvenient tragedy, at least for the Trump administration and for state governors like Andrew Cuomo, because it's impossible to look at this scale without starting to think about what could have been done to prevent it. To be fair, I mean, this has always been true. 9/11, there was a question whether or not the Bush administration should have seen it coming. There were questions raised about the Challenger disaster, whether or not NASA was asleep at the switch. But we have, in the past, been able to at least set aside those political concerns long enough to come together and grieve. So something has changed dramatically with regards to our ability as a nation to set aside politics and mourn together.
I guess it's easy to understand in the case of mass shootings, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Las Vegas, Orlando, why the national horror did not yield a national grief consensus, because gun violence yields gun control debate, which in this country yields reflexive denial and even perverse conspiracies of doubt. We seem to be seeing from the same sectors of the right wing similar attempts to question the simple reality of the COVID death toll.
Once you start downplaying the effect of mass shootings because it's politically inconvenient, you reach a point where you invite people like Sandy Hook truthers who suggest that there was no tragedy here at all, that this was a false flag. And that starts to pollute the discourse in a way we're seeing now, where you have people on the right trying basically to downplay the number of deaths by COVID-19.
The notion of suppressing grief as an instrument of politics and even revisionist history is not a novel result of the rise of Alex Jonesism. You right that we saw it in Iraq and Afghanistan as well?
In 2005, there was Freedom of Information request filed by a muckraker website called The Memory Hole to get the photographs of the dead soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan coming home to Dover Air Force Base. And these photos had been suppressed by the Defense Department. They were not released to the public. The policy was out of respect for the victims' families, but when the photographs were finally released, they were, by all accounts, very respectful. There's no denigration of the bodies of these soldiers. They're being treated reverentially. But the mere fact that you were documenting dead soldiers from these unpopular wars was too much of a political hot potato that the Bush administration was afraid that these images would get out.
And similarly, in the midst of Katrina, the grotesque harvest of government incompetence and indifference featured only the most boilerplate expressions of mourning from our leaders. In this case, again, President George W. Bush.
Exactly. And when Bush finally gives his speech about New Orleans,
when communities are rebuilt, they must be even better and stronger than before the storm. Within the Gulf region are some of the most beautiful and historic places in America.
He talks a lot about the devastation. He talks a lot about how the city's going to rebuild. He mentions some initiatives and some funds that are going to be freed up. He talks about a brighter future. What he cannot bring himself to bring up is the simple fact that people have died. He ends his speech by evoking the New Orleans jazz tradition of a second line where there's a somber parade to the funeral grounds. But once the body is buried,
the band breaks into a joyful second line, symbolizing the triumph of the spirit over death. Tonight, the Gulf Coast is still coming through the dirge. Yet we will live to see the second line.
He uses it as a metaphor to talk about what's happening, but he doesn't seem to also admit that that is a literal description, that there are actual dead that defined Katrina that were too difficult, I think, for politicians to address head on. And so they could only be broached through these roundabout uses of metaphor.
Even after 9/11, when the country was joined in abject grief, Bush quickly went from president as pastor to president as, I don't know, vigilante, using the enormity of the attacks to rally the nation to war.
Bush climbs the rubble with a megaphone and an American flag, and he says to the emergency crews and the construction workers,
I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Immediately telegraphing that any kind of mourning that we were going to do for the victims of that attack could only be conceived of in terms of revenge and getting back at the people who did this to us.
And vengeance, I'm pretty sure, is not the same thing as mourning.
Right. This Dr. Jonathan Shea, who worked with Vietnam veterans, wrote a book called Achilles in Vietnam, where he talks about part of the reason they had been suffering so severely from PTSD is because they had been more or less prevented from mourning the deaths of their comrades who had fallen in war, because Defense Department policy in the Vietnam War was to channel that grief directly into rage, fighting the enemy and killing more people.
During the Obama administration, after Sandy Hook, he expressed his grief, and when he actually came to tears,
every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad.
He was ridiculed by Fox News and other outposts of the right.
When people like Meghan McCain are saying that Obama's tears over the dead children at Sandy Hook are not authentic.
I don't understand why he's doing this. I agree with Andrea. The reason why I was reacting the way I was reacting when he was crying is because it just didn't seem horribly authentic. And maybe it is. I don't know him at all.
One of Fox's hosts suggested that he had hit an onion under his lectern. But I think most Americans saw in Obama's emotions a very real human response, giving weight and voice to what many of us were feeling around the country in a way that terrified the GOP.
Like almost everything else about the past 4 years, we cannot have this conversation without talking about the influence of Donald Trump. We for sure have no mourner in chief.
This is only a tragedy or even a thing of interest to Trump as it relates to Trump. And that is different from, you know, even somebody like George W. Bush, who at least understood that his job was to represent the nation as a whole, for better or for worse. Trump sees his job as to be lauded for what a good job he's doing. And the best way to do that is simply to deny that people are actually dying. The actual, you know, lives and deaths of American citizens are all just pawns in a very complicated, paranoid game of people who are out to get him personally.
We are still right in the middle, or not even the middle, of the pandemic. But what is the toll to the national psyche, the national soul, of not going through the process of coming to terms with the sheer scale of devastation? Where does this lack of communal grieving take us as a society?
Where we're at right now is this increasing push to get back to quote-unquote normal life. I mean, if you've lost a loved one, you know that it takes time to get back to normal life, even during normal circumstances. And if you don't have that space to grieve, if you're not given that space by friends and colleagues and coworkers, what happens is you end up in a lot of cases just repressing that, and it starts to affect you negatively in a whole host of ways. And I think the danger for this country is if we, quote unquote, get back to normal without, in the process, attempting to come to grips with everything that we've lost in the past couple of months and will continue to lose in the time going forward, then we're going to end up with a country that is deeply traumatized and unable to process that trauma.
Colin, thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Colin Dickey is the author most recently of Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places.
Coming up, the lessons of a pandemic past.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As we've heard this hour, in the absence of national leadership, we can grieve as individuals, as communities, as states, and we can mourn via stories and even statistics through the media. But what if we were slammed with a pandemic many times deadlier than this one, and the media were muzzled? What if the president never even mentioned it? Where would that leave our collective loss and our collective memory of it just a few generations later? In 1918 and 19, more than 50 million people died worldwide, including at least 675,000 Americans, in what has been called the Spanish flu. And yet, President Woodrow Wilson never addressed the nation's loss in any way. The first wave hit Europe's First World War battlefields in the spring. Not wanting to look weak, the Germans, the British, the French, and nearly everyone else kept mum. Nearly. According to John Barry, author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history, it was only covered by newspapers in neutral Spain. In fact, it was that coverage that gave the flu its name.
Spain was not at war, so it didn't censor its press. Plus, the king himself got sick, so there was a lot of press about it, and it got the name Spanish flu.
So the Spanish flu is not because it originated there, but because it was written about there and because the king got it.
Exactly. It was well established elsewhere before it ever arrived in Spain.
We do know that it spread on our shores out of control from a military base outside of Boston, right?
That was the first place that the second wave hit in the United States. I mean, the virus clearly changed. In the first wave, it was generally mild. There were actually medical journal articles saying this looks and smells like influenza, but it's not killing enough people, so it's probably not influenza.
There was a mutation between the first and second wave?
Almost certainly. I mean, we can't prove that through molecular biology, but epidemiologically, it seems quite certain.
Between 50 million and 100 million people worldwide were infected. That would equal, if you adjusted for population, somewhere between 200 and 400 million today. And there were roughly 675,000 killed in the U.S.
Right. An estimated 28% of the U.S. population was sick.
The second wave was the deadliest here. It was in the fall of 1918, right at the end of the war. But what would we have seen if we'd cracked open a local newspaper in autumn 1918?
Lots of war coverage, but very little about the pandemic. You know, there was an infrastructure that had been created for the war that the pandemic fell into. Wilson had created something called the Committee for Public Information, a propaganda arm, and the architect for that committee said truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms, but matters very little if it is true or false. So that was the attitude of the government propaganda machine. It also had passed a law making it punishable with 20 years in jail to, quote, utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, scurrilous, profane, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States.
This was the Sedition Act of 1918, right?
Yeah. A congressman was sentenced to more than 10 years in jail under that act, so publishers were threatened with it. Wilson himself, at one point, told a cousin, thank God for Abraham Lincoln. I won't make the mistakes he made, allowing a free press to flourish during the Civil War.
But Lincoln closed 300 newspapers.
Plenty of negative press about him in the re-election campaign of 1864. And again, going back to that Committee of Public Information, the guy who ran that, George Creel, wanted to create, quote, one white-hot mass with fraternity, devotion, courage, and deathless determination. They really tried to make Americans conform, have one way of thinking. I don't think we've ever experienced that before or since. More than the McCarthy period, more than any of the Red Scares. The press was determined to be as patriotic as anyone. For example, the Cleveland Plain Dealer wrote, what the nation demands is that treason, whether thinly veiled or quite unmasked, be stamped out. I could go on and give you other examples. You know, you had on the one hand the carrot, the idea that the press was supposed to be patriotic and inspire people to help in the war effort. And on the other hand, you had the stick of that Sedition Act. So the result, as a general rule, was a very cooperative, complacent press where there was, in fact, fake news because they were cooperating with the government line.
But all this intensity was also employed to muzzle coverage of the flu.
Exactly. There was a concern that any negative news, no matter what it was about, would damage the war effort by hurting morale.
But surely there were exceptions. The Jefferson County Union paper in Wisconsin, you've talked about?
Correct. When the pandemic hit there and they started to tell the truth about it, they were threatened with prosecution under the Sedition Act. There was no Tony Fauci back then. One national public health leader, quoted by the Associated Press, said this is ordinary influenza by another name. Another said the so-called Spanish influenza is nothing more or less than old-fashioned grip.
That sounds a little familiar.
Yeah. A few miles outside Little Rock was Camp Pike. 8,000 soldiers were admitted to the hospital in 4 days. The camp commandant stopped releasing the names of the dead. A doctor there wrote a colleague, every corridor, and there are miles of them, have a double row of cots with influenza patients. There is only death and destruction. The camp called upon Little Rock to supply civilian doctors and nurses and linens and coffins. And the Arkansas Gazette, just a few miles away, in its headline writes, quote, Spanish influenza is playing the grip, same old fever and chills. You have essentially the same thing happening everywhere. Des Moines, Iowa, for example, the city attorney was part of the emergency committee running the response to influenza. He wrote publishers, quote, I would recommend that if anything be printed in regard to the disease, it be combined to simple preventative measures, something constructive rather than destructive, unquote. And of course, you know, that carried with it the potential for prosecution.
What was constructive? What was destructive in this formulation?
Public health guidance, such as keep your windows open, avoid crowds, washing your hands, things like that, that would be considered constructive. Actually, printing news of what was happening was destructive.
Hmm. You also had remarkable details about the Espionage Act that involved the post office.
Right, and the postmaster was not going to allow anything negative, and what they regarded as negative was actually just the truth in many occasions, anything that they regarded as depressing to morale. Back then, of course, many of the news media was distributed solely through the mail, so that effectively was completely silencing publishers, effectively putting them out of business.
It would seem to be a terrifying time to be an American.
It was a violent, terrifying disease. People could turn so dark blue from lack of oxygen. The book I quoted, one physician writing a colleague, that he couldn't distinguish African-American soldiers from white soldiers because their pallor was so similar. In some camps, 15% of the soldiers with the disease had a nosebleed. But you could also bleed from your mouth, and you could bleed even from your eyes and ears. And when they are being told that this is ordinary influenza by another name, there are people dying 24 hours after the first symptoms. People very rapidly know they're being lied to. They lose all trust in authority. Rumor and panic spread. It leads to a fraying of society, in worst cases, almost a breakdown of society.
You contrast the cities of Philadelphia and San Francisco.
Philadelphia may be the most extreme example. Literally, thousands of people are dying, and they finally belatedly closed schools and bars and theaters and so forth, and finally took this act. One of the Philadelphia newspapers actually said, quote, "This is not a public health measure. You have no cause for panic or alarm," unquote. Beyond absurd. Of course, you're not going to believe anything you read, either in that paper or any paper. In Philadelphia, society really did almost begin to break down. There are reports of people starving to death because no one had the courage to bring them food. In San Francisco, by contrast, the mayor, medical leaders in the community, the business leaders, the trade union leaders all signed a joint statement in huge type in the newspaper, full page, said, "Wear a mask and save your life." It turns out those masks were not very useful, but that is a very, very different message than "this is ordinary influenza with another name." San Francisco functioned. It seemed to come together. When schools closed, teachers volunteered, even as ambulance drivers, which, of course, is a pretty risky thing to do. Compare that to Philadelphia, where people could starve to death because nobody had the courage to bring them food. I think it's directly related to the fact that people were told the truth and the leadership trusted the public. Both Philadelphia and San Francisco were extremely hard hit by the disease. San Francisco was right around fifth in the country in terms of excess mortality, which was about the same as Philadelphia. But in one city, you can see an absolute fraying of society. And in the other city, you see the community coming together and helping each other.
Woodrow Wilson got the flu. It resulted in intense disorientation, a decreased mental functioning that was a symptom of this particular pandemic at the absolutely wrong time.
You know, it was widely noted that people did become extremely disoriented and in some cases psychotic, then recovered. And, you know, Wilson got sick at Paris while negotiating the peace treaty. Everybody around him, from Irwin Hoover, who was the White House usher, to Herbert Hoover, commented on how they had never seen him like this. His mind wasn't functioning. German territories were essentially ceded to France. France was allowed to economically exploit German regions. Germany was saddled with huge reparations payments. And essentially every historian of the rise of the Nazis credits or blames that peace treaty for part of the rise of Hitler and subsequently World War II. John Maynard Keynes called Wilson the greatest fraud on earth after that peace conference.
The greatest fraud on earth. Wilson never, ever spoke about the flu, though, did he? We look at newspaper accounts. Those are muzzled and confused. What were you able to find about how people understood what was happening, or how they mourned the dead or tried to protect themselves?
There was a very serious scientist named Victor Vaughan, who during the war became a colonel, head of the Communicable Disease Division for the Army. And right at the height, he wrote, "If the current rate of acceleration continues for a few more weeks, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth." That is how bad it was beginning to get. And he happened to write that right at the peak, and things began to improve.
What about the artists, the novelists? We know Katherine Anne Porter wrote Pale Horse, Pale Rider, but there doesn't seem to be a lot written by observers, even by survivors.
You know, that has always puzzled me, the lack of literature about this. Nonetheless, it is clearly out there in the public mind. Christopher Isherwood was in Berlin. He wrote Berlin Stories, from which the great movie Cabaret came.
Mm-hmm.
When the Nazis entered Berlin, he said you could feel it like influenza in your bones, this kind of sense of deep dread. And this is 15 years after the pandemic. He certainly expected his readers to recognize dread that he was referring to. So it was out there, even if people weren't writing about it.
There was a period of generations where there was nary a mention of the epidemic. I don't think I was an exception to the rule. We knew more about the bubonic plague than
right.
We knew about the 1918 pandemic. How do you account for that?
You know, it was so fast. That's part of it. Probably 2/3 of the deaths worldwide occurred in a period of 14 or 15 weeks. And in any given community, it was roughly half that length of time. The influenza would hit a city, and 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks later, it was gone. You know, there may have been a third wave, depending where that city was. But that would come months later, and the third wave was still lethal enough, but it was nothing compared to the second wave. You had this incredible brevity, and life largely returned to normal pretty quickly. And it was ending almost simultaneously with the end of the war. November 11th, people are out celebrating, practically to the moment in many cities that they were coming out of their lockdown. As I'm talking now, I can sort of see part of the forgetfulness, except for those who had personally suffered. 2/3 of the dead were people aged 18 to 45, and the elderly hardly suffered at all. But kids under the age of 5 died at a rate equal today to all-cause mortality for a period of 23 years. Just think of that. Kids dying today from all causes over a period of 23 years. Compress that into a period of a few weeks in 1918 and think of the toll that would take on parents.
But I have to ask you, 675,000 dead in the U.S., adjusted for population, that would be 2 million?
Yeah.
And yet, when it was over, was there ever a moment of national mourning? Was there ever a monument erected to the dead? Was there ever a recognition of the immense tragedy?
In terms of individual recollection, yes. I remember telling my aunt, who was about 10 years old during the pandemic, what I was doing, and she essentially grasped her chest, practically started crying. So it was not something forgotten by individuals, that tragedy. As a society, no. I've thought about this for 20 years, and I haven't got a decent explanation.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
John Barry is the author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, and professor at Tulane's School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. A couple of weeks ago, when the number of American dead from COVID-19 surpassed that of the Vietnam War, USA Today opinion writer David Colton asked, "Why is the grieving so hard?" We tried to answer some of that this hour. It may be the isolation those of us who are able took on for our own protection, or the prospect of worse waves to come, or the implication of weakness that terrified the leaders who presided over the slaughter of the First World War and our own maskless commander-in-chief today. No, this president will not preside over national mourning, but we will find a way. In fact, this pandemic may enable us to do more than unite to mourn our dead. It has etched in sharp relief the even deadlier impact of inequality long residing in the shadows. The South African philosopher, performer Mokokomo Mokonuana once said, "Some people are gone, but not forgotten. Some people are still here, but already forgotten." If we could really hold those people in memory, now that truly would be a memorial for the ages.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.